Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support. If you're a business owner and you want to increase your cash flow, or if you're a label or artist and you want to promote new music, then listen up. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area, in Hillsborough, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We're going to show some love to the rhythm section today. Man, we're with one of the coolest guests that I'm going to have on this show. I've been really looking forward to talking to Matt Bissonette. Like the first time we talked, we had like an hour plus conversation. He's a lovely, just a, one of the nicest deepest kind people that you're going to hear. So I'm really happy to have him on the show. Matt is, if you don't know him, I'm sure you do if you're listening to this, one of the best bass players around, background vocalist. He's currently been out with Elton John since 2012. I want to read his background, but a couple of things. First of all, thank you to Danny Jacob and my man Doug Bossy for the connection. And don't forget, you can watch this on YouTube now, in addition to listening to the show on iTunes or wherever else you get it. And one quick announcement, if you can, Tony Iommi, Jimmy Page, Santana, Mick Taylor, or Joe Walsh, man, if you can connect me with any of those guys, love to have them on my show. Please make the connection. All right, Matt Bissonette. Dad was a drummer. His mom played piano. And his brother, Greg, of course, is also a drummer. His early career dreams really had more to do with playing sports than music. But when he was 12, his parents bought him a bass guitar. They were out of guitars that day in the store. And he's been playing it ever since. Once he learned to play, Matt earned pocket money playing in a wedding band and went on to join school jazz bands, local rock bands. Despite his early success, his mom insisted that he learn how to read music and how to play and the trombone, which, thank you, was a chore at the time, but obviously now he's extremely grateful to have had those skills. His early live gigs included stints with the Kingston Trio and the Ink Spots, as well as playing the local Detroit scene, including a residency at the Detroit Lions football games. In 1979, Matt attended North Texas State University. 2 years later, he left college to join Maynard Ferguson's band and tour the world. That was like a recruiting. Didn't Maynard like recruit everybody from North Texas?
He did. He knew, first of all, Maynard was ahead of his time, and he was a rock star, you know. I mean, he didn't just play. He was, you know, great jazz trumpet player, but he knew to be a front man, and he knew how to get people to come to his shows. And it was really like a rock show with jazz. And so he knew also that he could get really good musicians that were eager to go out on the road, because you're pretty much getting in a Greyhound bus, you know, 20 guys driving 1,000 miles. So he would always get young guys that probably didn't know any better, and you know, and could just do it, you know. So he was he would recruit from Berkeley and North Texas and Miami and all those schools, and he would pick up people all over the place. He was a very, very smart man.
Man, I've spoken to probably 10 people that I play with Maynard. So, yeah, all through those schools, mostly North Texas, some Miami, and then I guess last would probably be Berkeley.
Yeah, yeah, they're all over the place. He's, yeah, it was quite an experience.
Later, Matt moved to L.A., and he had the distinction of playing five sets a day in the Disneyland Band in Anaheim, a gig that he describes as one of the best ones he ever had, and we'll talk about that in a minute. In Los Angeles, Matt's musical career took off. He played every night in clubs, joined bands, and he went on the road with a wide range of artists, including A440, Gino Vannelli, Sheena Easton, Christopher Cross, The Captain, and Tennille. In 88, Matt and his brother Greg joined David Lee Roth's band, and they spent the next 2 years touring the world to promote the Skyscraper album. After that, Matt relocated to Vancouver with David Lee Roth, his brother Greg, Jason Becker, and the great Steve Hunter, who is on this show, to record David Lee Roth's next album, which is A Little Ain't Enough. After that world tour, Matt and Greg left and joined Joe Satriani's band, where they made five albums with Joe. And Joe was also on this show. Another great interview if you want to check that out. Matt's also played with Rick Springfield, Jeff Lynne and ELO, Ringo Starr, Brian Wilson, Don Henley, Julian Lennon, Steve Perry, Ty Tabor, and Peter Frampton. But what everybody wants to know is, and by everybody, I mean Doug and George, when are the Mustard Seeds, when is the next Mustard Seeds album coming back? What a great band, dude.
Oh, thanks, man. That was the funnest band ever. That was the best.
What, is there like, is there ever another album? Is there ever another Mustard Seeds album?
Well, we kind of, we all kind of went in our own different directions for years. And then we just decided, you know, cause you know, back in the old days, you know, old days being 1992 when we put the band together. I mean, it was always like, you know, you do an album and you go to Capitol and you record everything and then you do your vocals there and everything. And like $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 later, you're going, now what do we do? You know, so you got to make up that money. So now with everybody having everybody in the band has home studios. So we decided after our second record in 1996 to just kind of do the, you know, we got together to write the songs at my house and then everybody kind of went their ways and did their parts. And, you know, it was great because everybody got to express themselves, which is the reason why we put the band together. It was never like I wrote the songs or Doug or George or my brother or Jorge, the drummer. We really wanted to make it a community of everybody writing and contributing, you know, and the Van Halen approach of splitting the songs so everybody stays in the band, you know, and making it a real, you know, an open thing. So it was easy to do the last record and we always, you know, talk about doing it again. I just don't know when and where, but I'm probably, hopefully before we leave the earth, it'll be another smash hit.
I hope so, man. Well, I listened to the second and the third record. They're both wonderful, man. Really great records, man.
Well, thank you very much.
Really great records. Thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it. I've been looking forward
to
this.
Thanks for having me, man. When you say that stuff, it makes me feel really old when you say it like that. You know, all your research, you're quite the guy.
You being a sports guy, I got to believe playing Detroit Lions was like huge for you.
Yeah. My brother started playing drums from birth, you know, and he was always running around the house hitting things and he'd be in the basement playing drums. And I remember when we'd eat dinner, he'd be down in the basement playing, practicing his drums. And when it was time for dinner, my mom would go and flicker the light real quick. And then he would play his signature. And you hear the sticks go down. He comes up and we eat dinner. You know? So he was always around this.
She was cueing him.
His first light cue. And my mom and dad were both musicians, you know, and my sister sang. And it was kind of a musical family. But before we got into that, I was kind of fighting the whole music thing because I didn't really like it. I didn't really like music that much. I just kind of grew up watching sports with my dad, being a Detroit fan, Lions, you know, Tigers, Pistons, and Red Wings. And it was really, as a young man, I just kind of gravitated to sports and I really loved it and didn't really think about anything about music until I was about eight or nine. I would start listening downstairs in the basement to band, you know, Kansas and Rush and different bands, and put my little headphones on and have a guitar as a tennis racket. You know, have a tennis racket, turn the lights off, and it just, you know, like every kid does, you start goofing off, and then it starts like, this is pretty cool, you know. And I never intended on being a musician. It just kind of, you know, my dad was a working musician playing on the weekends, and playing in clubs and bars and stuff and weddings. And my brother was working with him. He'd play drums, and he would play on the rock tunes and disco songs that my dad didn't want to play because he kind of jazz and stuff like that and different, you know, society songs and everything. But he would bring my brother along, and he would set the drums up for my dad and then sit in the wings, and then my dad would point to him, and he'd come out there and play those songs. And I was kind of a million miles away from all that stuff until they – you know, my brother was kind of talking to me, going, it'd be great to, you know, do stuff together, you know. And then one day my mom and dad bought me a bass, and I thought it was a guitar. You know, I didn't know what the difference was because I was just banging away on a tennis racket. And we both got in the basement, and we plugged in my little amp and just started playing Smoke on the Water for like 8 hours down in the basement. I realized what a bass does. It's not the bow, 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 it's the dumb guy part, you know. And so I kind of, the light went on, and I just kind of got into it, and I liked it. And then like 2 weeks later, literally, my dad bought me a tuxedo and said, if you want to make $50 a night, you can just come play with my wedding band, you know. Like, and I was like, you know, what do I do? You know, I don't even know what to do. And he was so cool. He just said, well, whatever you want to do, just use your ear and play and just kind of listen, and then whenever I want a beer, I'll point to you and you go get me a beer.
So you're gonna get he's gonna get value out of you regardless. Yeah. If you can play or not.
So literally since I was probably 12, I was working every Friday, Saturday, making 50 bucks a night. And that's the Detroit thing, really is a work ethic based thing. I know Bob Birch, the bass player I replaced with Elton, had an amazing work ethic, because it's kind of the area where you grow up. You just learn in Detroit and back East, it's a little tougher, and it's a little bit, you earn what you get, you know, very work oriented city. So pretty much since I was 11 or 12, I was making a couple hundred bucks, you know, $400 or $500 a month, which was like gold back then, you know.
Sure.
Putting it away and just trying to learn how money works and stuff like that, and then learning how to play. And this accordion player named Harry Demersion, he was the accordion player with my dad. God bless him, man. I don't know what I was playing or if it even made sense, but he just smiled at me and just play and like pat me on the back and say I'm doing good and everything. So, I mean, the main thing in my life is I've been very blessed to be around supportive people. I've only had a few instances where people have been kind of jerks and kind of did things, but I think God put people in my life that just have guided me and always gave me positive feedback. So even the people that I work with today and through my life, it's always been really great people, you know? So like with Doug and George and the guys in the band, it was always just really fun and natural, you know? So it wasn't really ever work. It just kind of was fun.
Man. So a few things or a couple of questions about that. You're a dad now. Your dad, and as a father myself, can you imagine how good he felt that he had both of his sons play? I mean, that must have been just such a treat for him.
I know exactly how it
feels. Yeah.
He was a musician, and he was really good. He was a really great drummer, and he had his own big band, and he just was a really good drummer. So when Greg and I got the gig with Maynard, it was like striking gold for him, because one of my first concerts I ever saw was Maynard Ferguson with Peter Erskine playing Chameleon and all that stuff. And we grew up on that stuff. So, and Maynard played with Stan Kenton, and that was one of my first concerts. And I was kind of dragged into those concerts in the beginning because I didn't think I'd like them. But I remember seeing Don Ellis. It was my first
concert. Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking it's just stinking jazz stuff. It's going to be
trumpet player, right? Yeah, it's really good.
He walks out on stage in this parka, this hippie parka, turns his back on the crowd, drops his parka, picks up his trumpet, starts going crazy. And I'm like, this is pretty cool. Well, it was kind of like, you know, I mean, I got into listening to jazz, but I also got into the whole rock thing, jazz, you know, fusion thing. So when we would go see these shows, my dad would be kind of checking us out, kind of ushering us into, this is what the music is, and you might like it, you might not like it, but just be open-minded. So when we got the gig with Maynard, you know, 20 years later, whatever, when I was 19 or 20 when I got the gig, and I can imagine what my dad felt like, because he would, him and my mom and him would surprise us, and he would just drive to Cincinnati. We get off the bus and there they were going, hey,
man,
sometimes going, oh, hey, mom and dad are here. And it was awesome because they just were in the middle of it. And my dad and my mom, up until they passed away, they would do drum cartage for my brother. So we would show up at a session and my dad knew everybody and they would know him by name. And I remember Greg did a session for David Foster once, and my brother was first time working with him, and he goes, hey dad, you know, if you set the drums up, kind of stay in the distance, you know, cause you know, I'd never worked for David Foster before. And sure enough, Greg shows up at the session and my dad's at the sound bowl with David Foster. Greg goes, hey dad, why don't you come back? And David goes, hey Greg, it's okay. I'm talking to Bud. We're talking Detroit Red Wing hockey. You know? So my dad was really in it, and he was always in it. Very, very, you know. So, you know, fast forward to me being a parent of a kid who loves sports.
Right.
My son Joshua became a baseball player at like 3 years old. We were like, he was throwing both hands, and when he was a little kid, and I was seeing this kid's got a talent for this. And we just said, you know, you don't want to be one of those hovering parents that goes, you know, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. But that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
When he, all through high school, he was playing in high school ball and little league and all that stuff. And we noticed that he was really good. So anyway, fast forward, he gets a scholarship to go to Baylor University to play baseball. Mm. And then he just got drafted by the Pittsburgh Pirates. So thus the Pittsburgh Pirate hat. And we just went and visited him last week, seeing him, you know, playing professional baseball in the minor leagues, and he's getting a paycheck every week for playing baseball. So I guess that makes it professional.
Yeah.
So I know what that feels like, because you can't even put into words how you see your kid doing something like that. And something that's out of the box, like my dad and mom got us into music. I mean, come on, that's a crazy, you're going to do that for a living, you know?
Right.
Like your son wants to play baseball for a living. I mean, it's kind of the same thing in different worlds, but the chances of survival through that are low. And if you keep creeping up the ranks, you just can't. I have seen a hand on my life and my family's life that I can only explain as God just saying, take these lives and put them in different places that are interesting lives, you know, that are just different than most, you know. So we're very, very thankful for that. And just thankful that my son is moving forward and playing ball. It's kind of a dream.
So yeah, man. Well, congratulations on your son.
Thank you.
That's really cool. And that's the first analogy. You know, many guys say, hey, I'm so grateful that I get to do this. The only other thing that would be similar is athlete. That's the first thing every musician says.
Yeah. And it's kind of the hit or miss thing. You either are a failing musician or a successful musician or a athlete that tried and has to go do something else because he wasn't, you know, quote unquote, good enough, or you're making billions of dollars. On either way, you're either doing, I mean, it's more difficult probably just to kind of skim along as a musician or a sports guy, because you're either in or out, and you know pretty early whether you're going to have that be a living, you know. And it's different than any other thing on the planet, you know.
It's similar to musicians, because they can make millions of dollars as well. Matt, what do you consider like your big breakthrough musically, as far as making it, or, you know, getting validated that, you know, hey, I'm in the right place here? And maybe it was a Maynard gig, I don't know.
When I started in Detroit, I was kind of just like a ship without a rudder, kind of just going in every direction. And at that time in 1973, 74, 76, whatever, music was so different, because you could turn on the radio on your car and then you hear a weather report on this channel. Then you hear Chicago, then you hear Kansas and Rush, and you hear all this music. It was like an open thing. So I was kind of all over the place and I liked everything. In high school and junior high school, I got into big band stuff and reading, and just like you said earlier, my mom got me into trombone, which was amazing because she knew I needed to not just be able to jam and hear and listen with my ear, but to be able to know music and other instruments and stuff. So,
and is that the same? Is that in bass? Trombone is in bass, or is that in?
Yeah, they're both trombone.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, yeah.
But I tried to, you know, she got me into reading treble clef as well and different things, and trying to just broaden the picture, you know. And she was really the driving force that kind of made us practice, took us to lessons and stuff when my dad was working. And she was pretty amazing, visionary for that stuff. And they were just great parents for that stuff. So I kind of was kind of finding my way. And then when I got into high school, I remember we were driving my van, which was the party van back in Detroit. And we were on the last day of school, graduation. And I remember pulling the van around because we were going to soap some windows or do something crazy. And all the guys, when we pulled around the school, they pulled the van door open and they mooned the school. And the principal and all his supervisors saw them, all these butts hanging out of the van. They were counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I was so freaked out, we went and painted my van. Came back to school, and there's the principal, you know, come into the room, and he goes, asked my dad to come down and said, you know, we're thinking of not letting him graduate because this was just, you know. So I'm in the hallway freaking out, but he's in the room with my dad, and he shuts the door and he goes, "Bud, I got to do something because this was, you know, a big thing, but it was actually pretty funny. Let's just make him sweat by not graduating, you know." So that was kind of my first moment where I was like, oh man, there's life after high school and after driving around in my van. And if I don't go to college or do something, what am I going to do? Because at that time, Greg was already at North Texas. He was in his second year. And I kind of just followed my brother everywhere he went. You know,
right.
He goes, "You should come down here." So I
finally, what a nice, like, both times I've heard you, when he said, "Hey, why don't you check out," it sounds like what a good relationship, you know, what a great, loving big brother, man.
Yeah, he's a big brother and my best friend. And it's just like, it's just a friend thing. And we've always kind of opened doors for each other for different things, but I can honestly say I've ridden his coat feathers on the majority of things. And I've noticed with him, he's just got a great instinct for business and for music and stuff. And that's why we like to work together so much. So I just kind of followed him. And when he kind of talked me into going to school down there. So when I got down there, I was kind of floored because I went as a music ed degree. So I was going to play classical bass and jazz, but my degree would have been for music ed. And I realized early that I wasn't very good with the bow. I mean, I was playing with the orchestra, and I remember this orchestra teacher didn't like me very much because I was playing in the jazz band as well. And I had to miss a couple rehearsals or something. And he kind of had an attitude about jazz guys. So he would do this thing where we'd be playing, there'd be three basses and we're all playing bows, and we'd play this part. And then he'd go, okay, basses, a bar 199, 3, 4. We'd play like this and play. And he'd go, "Okay, stop." He'd go, "You." And he'd point at me. And I'd be like, you know, just squeaky sound. And he would just kind of get in my grill for that stuff. And I realized kind of early that I wasn't really a classical player. And then I was kind of going, I don't really want to get a music ed degree to teach anyway, because I kind of want to play and go out on the road and stuff or whatever. And then part of me was just going, I don't even know if I like music enough to continue it. And I was my third year of school, I was going to go back to sports and get a PE degree or something like that. So along the way, when I was at North Texas,
well, dude, you look like a gym teacher right now, like with that outfit on. Yeah, I mean, give me Tony Pleasure. Yeah.
I mean, I just love sports. I mean, I never really been like the musician-y look type guy. I just kind of am normal. You know, when I go to my son's games, all the parents thought I was a construction driver or a professor. So, I mean, I've never really buckled to worry about like the image thing. I'm kind of like Joe. And Joe, I listened to your interview with Joe, and it's kind of like, kind of don't fit that box. You just kind of, you know, do whatever.
Satriani?
Yeah. Really cool. I mean, Joe's great. And
great guy.
And I relate to him. We used to talk about that stuff all the time. But so basically, when I got to college, I was kind of going, I was just around a bunch of really, really great players. And they were like, when you in sports, you get into another team and there's a whole other level. I remember the first time I went to a club and I heard Gary Willis. I don't know if you ever heard of Gary Willis, baseball player. Mm-hmm. He's like this phenom guy that plays every note with a different string, you know, because I'm basically just a straight ahead guy with two or three fingers. But he would play with his, like a guitar. He was a flamingo guitar player, like a acoustic player. And so he could play 10 times faster than anybody. And I saw him at a club my first weekend at school. And I told my brother, I went back home and started packing my stuff going, I'm done. If everybody plays like this guy, there's no future for me. I got to get out of here. And he talked me into staying. And I just started getting better because I was playing with better musicians. You know, it's like, you know, there's nothing worse than when you're growing up in a city and you're forced to play with whoever those players are at that city who are the big sure. fish in that city. And like when you play with a drummer as a bass player and he starts slowing down, it's like having a monkey on your back and it's the end of the world. So when I got to that school, it was the level was so high that it just made you play better. And I remember one day I was in a small group with a bunch of guys that were really good. Tim Reese was a sax player. Barry Smith was a drummer, and Dave Alexander and was a trumpet player. And I noticed the jazz guy, whose name was Dan Hurley, who was the leader of the small groups. We played a concert for all the people to watch and judge us and tell us what we were doing. And he made the note. He goes, I want to make a special thing for this guy, Matt, bass player, because I've seen him make strides in the last 2 years, you know. And I didn't even know that was happening. I was just listening to records every day, practicing every day. And back then in North Texas, they'd have these things called sessions, right? Now sessions are how much do I make it this session to record? But back then, you would put your upright and your electric bass in the car. You'd drive to somebody's house. You'd set up and you would play real book tunes for like 3 or 4 hours with four horn players. And you're just playing bass for like hours where all these guys are soloing and just playing and just sweating and bleeding and just. And then you pack up your stuff and then you go to another jam session and you do 3 or 4 of those a day. Wow. So as far as school, I learned the stuff at school, but it was the outside of the school thing that I learned how to communicate with musicians and how that was happening and what music really was. And the main thing was just listening to everything and being open-minded to every kind of music. We used to play four nights a week with my brother and Paul Van Amelia, a piano player from Detroit, at a country bar. We had a country band where we all had to sing. So we were doing everything, you know, and playing every kind of music and not saying, I'm not going to play this or I'm going to play that, just being real open-minded, you know? So when Greg was playing in Dallas at a club and he wanted to play with Maynard really bad. So he knew Maynard was playing in Dallas and he invited them to come down to this club called Buster Brown's. I think it was called, he was in a band called Buster Brown in a club called Popsicle Toes. And they came down there. Maynard didn't come, but the trumpet player, Stan Mark, did. And he goes, you're going to be the next drummer in this band, right? So a couple months later, they needed a bass player and a piano player and a sax player. So Greg recommended me. And so I had to put together an audition tape, send it to Maynard. And then he called me and I got the gig. But at that time, I was just turning 20 and I was getting burned out on music school and I was going to switch degrees. So that mid-season of school, I quit school and just went on the road with Maynard. So, and then Greg, a year later, came out after Dave Mancini, the original drummer, quit. So all these things kind of went like a Christmas tree straight up towards this spot of just going, now I know what I want to do. And then when I went on the road with Maynard, it kind of reedified, I love music. I love doing this. Let's just do this for a living, you know, kind of.
That's cool. Were your parents were cool with your decision to leave?
Oh yeah, they didn't care what we did as long as we were happy, playing music. I mean, they were just thrilled about that. You know?
It's funny because we all do things in life, and we all, you know, everybody has obstacles whenever you're doing anything, and they're normal. But because we're all alone, nobody knows that it's normal. What made me think of that is when you said, oh man, I saw this guy play, Dave Willis, is that I think you said?
Gary Willis.
And I felt like quitting. So I got to tell you, I've interviewed, let's say 550 people, at least 10% of them have told me that story. Whether it's guitar players, bass players, you know, and at the time you think you're alone, you know, but it's interesting. Every where everybody's experiencing the same stuff at different, you know, when you're doing stuff, when you're moving forward with your life. Yeah. And it's just so interesting to hear this, and that, you know, it's a good reminder for myself and hopefully for everybody listening that, you know, if you're stuck in something, man, you're not alone, you know, you're not the first guy that's.
Yeah, man, all this stuff. I mean, music is important. It's great. And it's an amazing thing. But there's so much more important things than playing your instrument and playing and having a job, playing music and all that stuff. And that's just life in general, you know, and trying to be a good person and trying to have something that you believe in, and having a thing that just makes your life better and makes other people's lives better by what you do. And adversity is the thing, man. It's the teacher that when people don't have it, they become spoiled and they become bad people. So anything that's ever, I mean, even recently, like at home, we have, I've been out on the road, you know, for a long time with Elton, 7 years now. This last year was probably the toughest year of my life because there's a bunch of first world problems, nothing big, but just little things that really tested your spirit to see if you just, you know, what you're going to do. Because in the old days, when I would have problems, I would drink or I would do stupid stuff, you know. And then when you grow up a little bit, you kind of go, I don't have to do that, but I have to deal with this pain head on.
Yeah.
I'm going to medicate myself. I'm not going to pretend it didn't happen, but I'm going to deal with it, you know. And I remember the few times that I had adversity situations, there was a keyboard player I worked with back in Detroit. It's hilarious. I went down his basement in my middle year of college and I had my upright and I was thinking I was Eddie Gomez at the time, where when I'd solo, I'd close my eyes and go really high up on the acoustic neck, and the way he plays is just amazing. And I thought I was Eddie Gomez Jr., you know, and I went down in this guy's basement and we're jamming because we're going to play in the summer in Detroit on my off year from college. And I go to take my solo, and while I'm playing, my eyes are closed and I'm thinking I am the most amazing player. these guys are loving me and they're blessed to have me come from North Texas back to Detroit. And then I hear the keyboard player whose band it was stops comping. He stops playing. And I'm thinking he must be freaking out how good I am because he's supposed to listen to me. And then I'm playing and then the drums stop and I'm going, oh man, he's digging on me too. This is pretty cool. And then I'm playing and I open my eyes and they're looking at me with this disgusted look on their face. And I'm going, what's going on? And then the keyboard player just unloaded on me. What the? Blah, blah, blah. You're doing, man. How can you disrespect us like this? And I didn't know this whole Detroit scene, what was going on. And he freaked on me. I mean, now if somebody said that to me, I would just pack up my stuff and go, have a nice day. See you later. But I was so young and impressionable, I wanted to do a good job. I spent the whole summer working with this band, trying to fit in and trying to do what he wanted me to do. Granted, all these years later, I can look back and go, that made me grow 10 years.
Yeah.
Because every time I would play a wrong change or a turnaround or something, he had this vein that went in his neck. He would yell at me, freak out. My mom and dad would come and they'd go, why are you putting up with this? And go, I just want to be a better player. You know, this is the worst thing that happens to me. So I went that whole summer with this guy on me. And that probably made me a lot better player. So then when I went back to school, I kind of grew a little bit more and I was ready for that. But those kind of situations, whether they're unpleasant or not, when they're happening, really make you the man or woman that you are. And and even this last year, man, with, you know, we had some problems with our house with mold issues and stuff. And my wife was sick and I was out on the road and we're putting money into our house to try and fix it. We try and sell the house. We have this buyer who are buying our house and he's been nothing but a pain making us do stuff. My son, we didn't know if he was going to get drafted or not for baseball. And, just a million little things. And I thought I was going to crack, you know, because it was like, I can't go out to the bar. I can't do anything really stupid. I just got to deal with this pain and figure it out. And so sometimes I think that stuff, you know, when you have horrible musical experiences, they usually come back to help you in some weird, wacky way. So yeah. I'm not welcoming that stuff. I'm not saying I like it or I want it, but kind of learning as an older person now that there are reasons for everything you go through.
Yeah. I have this expression and I need to tell it to myself more often sometimes, but you can't connect the dots moving forward.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's always, you know, like you said, adversity always makes you stronger, but you don't know what that looks like. And, you know, you often want to say, okay, listen, just let me get to the end already and pay the dues and let's expedite the pain. You know, the pain is in the process.
Yeah, exactly, man. And that's life in general, nothing's easy. I mean, You kidding me? We're musicians. You know, this is a guitar show, and I'm a bass player and thankful to be on a show for guitar. But I mean, it all, but I mean, are you serious? We picked this to bring up a family, you know, in real life. I mean, everybody loves to play and it's fun, but when you dive in and really do it, you got to have some kind of plan of, is this what you want to do with your life? Because there's a million guys that play for fun and that's great. And they're probably happier than we are because we have to make a living at it or have some kind of plan. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, how crazy it is that we're all doing this. And, you know, I mean, through your show, you're doing this for a living, making, you know, interviewing people around the world. And I mean, you have a plan for what you want to do. You just don't just go, I think I'm going to do this. You got to have some kind of, you know, projectile where you're going to, you know, and sometimes musicians aren't the smartest tools in the shed to begin with, you know, so it takes some thinking, you know.
You know, I know what you're saying, but I think and I know you're being facetious. I was amazed at how bright most musicians are. You know, I didn't necessarily have any preconceived notions, but musicians are very big readers.
Yeah.
Very big. And usually when people read, they tend to be bright. I don't think, it's weird. They're almost allergic to business though. And I don't understand. And there's no business curriculum given to you guys, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But there is.
As Steve Lukather says, there's no business. Right? because most guys I know, they our percussionist with Elton's band, John Mahan, he went to do a talk with a music school, and they wanted to have him on to how you succeed in the music business. And the first thing he says is, okay, so I want everyone to raise their hand that bought a CD or an album or something in the last 2 weeks. No hands. 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 5 years. Nobody's hands went up, right? I mean, you're talking about downloading a song, paying for it.
Yeah.
He looked at him and just says, well, I don't even know why I'm here. Because if you're not going to support your own livelihood, you think anybody else is, you know?
Yeah, man.
And so we're in a business that's kind of a sinking ship, whether we want to admit it or not. It's a beautiful business. It's a beautiful thing to make music, to make a CD. I mean, I have an attic full of literally 20,000 CDs that nobody will ever hear of my own.
Yeah.
But I had to do them, and I had to spend the money because I wanted to and I needed to, because music is something that, you know, you just have to get it out. And if you can do it, if you can, you know, now it's a lot easier than it used to be, but I had to throw pretty much most of those CDs away when we were moving our house because they're just taking up space.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody's really, I don't know if the music business will ever turn around. I don't even know how bands do it now. I'm sure there's the millennial smart thing of the YouTube videos and the merchandise and stuff like that. To me, I've already been around the rodeo a million times, and I'm like going, how do you squeeze grape juice out of these grapes anymore? You
yeah.
know? So I applaud the new generation for what they're doing. I mean, this is kind of the last, you know, guys like Elton and Ringo and, you know, all these guys that have been around, when this leaves the earth, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the music business. And I'm optimistic that it can be as strong as ever, but you just don't cut the legs off of music like it has been done in the last 15 years. I mean, I used to write music for TV and movies and stuff, and you'd get, you know, you'd send in a song, you'd get $1,500 up front, you'd get your publishing, and then you'd get a back fee, you'd $2,500 like that. And then you got hundreds of songs working, making money.
Right.
This is a business. And then 10, 15 years ago, bands started giving their music away for promo for their band. And companies seize that and they start saying, well, why should we pay you anything? So musicians have done that to themselves. And we may be smart and book smart and stuff like that, but we have kind of killed our own business. And that's not.
No, I hear you.
So then it just comes down to the point in my life. I go, what do I want to do? And how much do I want to spend to make something, knowing that probably no one's going to really support it or buy it? supporting or buying even the biggest things, you know? So I learned my lesson with why we were talking earlier about Facebook and, you know, having things.
Social media.
Yeah. So social media, sorry. I've been so removed from that because my last experience was I'd make CDs, make 1,000 of them, spend a bunch of money to have them, put them on CD Baby, and they'd sell sometimes more than others. But over the years, I just saw this decline happening where I'm going, people aren't buying music anymore. So then I got the gig with Elton, and I said, you know what? I need a write-off. I'm going to write a Christmas EP, 5 songs, and I'm going to give it away and on my website. And I said on my website, this is after thousands of CDs where people buy 200, 300 of them over the years, you know, and you never really make back your money for it. So I put out this Christmas CD and I say, I'm going to give away 1,000 CDs. First ones, first come, first. Within an hour, they were all gone. And that's when the light went on for me.
Wow.
And I had people complaining that they didn't get their CD in time for Christmas.
Oh, don't get me started on that, man. Please.
Getting a free product that somebody spent money on.
Why didn't you ship it FedEx?
Yeah.
How dare you give me a free CD and it's late? That's bullshit, man.
How dare you talk about Jesus on a Christmas CD?
Yeah. You know, how dare you talk about Jesus on a Christmas CD? So, what's going on?
the light went on and I just kind of went, that's great, you know, but I just don't want to do that anymore. So,
why? That sounded awesome. I know you played at Disneyland. Did you play with Jorgensen?
No. John played a little bit before I did. And we were just talking. John subbed for Davey on our last tour that we did in Europe. And he told me that he said to say hi, by the way.
Oh, cool.
John was a couple years before me because John grew up in California.
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing that, you know, pretty much in high school. So I got to, after North Texas and after going out with Maynard, Greg moved to L.A. And then he said, you should come to L.A. And I followed him, of course. And then got out there. And then I was there for about 4 or 5 months. And then I got called to be in a band in New York City called Casper, which was like a British rock band. So I moved to New York for a few months, probably 6 months. And then I...
Really? Who was in that?
I was this guy named Casper, who was a really good guitar player, singer guy from England. And he had some hits in like 83.
Interesting.
And he just hired a band out and we, you know, played in the band every day and then rehearsed and stuff, played a few shows. And then I could kind of, it started getting so cold back there. And I was, I remember I was so broke that me, the drummer and I lived in a house named Dave Beal. And it was so cold and we were so broke. But the last night before I left, we were sleeping in the same sleeping bag in the middle of the floor with the oven open.
Just to stay warm.
Yeah, and I woke up to go to the bathroom, and I looked at him, and he had icicles in his nose. And I went, "That's it, I'm done. That's it."
Oh my God!
I probably die from a stove. So, got in the car, came back to L.A., and then just started working. I mean, I just started playing top 40 gigs, just playing, learning the songs. Got in the top 40 band, and then started playing in a jazz band with a guitar player named Pat Kelly. Really great guitar player with my brother, and we would play that. And then I heard about at that time I started playing, I was playing 7 nights a week, top 40.
Wow.
3 nights a week with one band, and 2 nights a week with another band called Donna and the Kids. I can't remember the name of the other band, but they were really good. We played at this club called Wompuppers up in Universal Studios. So at that time I was, you know, making pretty good money and stuff. And then I got called to audition for Disneyland. So I, you know, drove out to Disney and did the audition. And that's the funny thing. It's kind of like you never know what's going to happen with everything. I remember Bernie Dressel, the drummer, he set me up with the audition. And there's like 50 bass players all sitting around. And it was for the band that comes up from the ground, the Tomorrowland Terrace. And I remember the band came up and I was looking and I saw this girl singer. And I was like, oh, man, who is this girl? You know? And I just fixated looking at her, you know, and they're checking up guys. And I went up and auditioned and we were talking, laughing. And then I was like, going, man, I better not get this gig. Cause I'm going to, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with that. And sure enough, I get the gig. Band. And from that gig, I met my wife, and she, the singer, was my wife.
Oh man, that is so cool.
Later on, we got married. And
that's
then
so cool.
one of my best friends was the drummer, Sergio Gonzalez, and all the guys in the band, I've kept in touch with them. So I met probably five or six really, really good friends to this day that are like my best friends and my wife. You know?
That's so amazing.
Never, you know, I've just learned to say yes to whatever I can because you never know something like that. You know, so just played in top 40, you know, played. So I'd play 7 nights a week and then, you know, get up early and drive to Disneyland in Anaheim from my house in the valley. So like a 2-hour drive.
Oh, wow.
Play from 11 to 5, get something to eat, and then go straight to the top 40 gig. I did that for a year. And then I was in a band called A440. And then we went on the road for a while. Then the Gino gig happened. And all this stuff started happening. Sheena Easton, different band. Then just a bunch of different things came out of it. And then led to David Roth's gig. It was really just saying yes to everything, you know, and just doing it.
That I remember John said that was such great training because you'd play 4 or 5 different genres of music every day, you know, to costumes. And I mean, he said it was like free tuition.
Yeah. Well, John's such a musicologist. Him and Jim Cox are two guys that I feel like I don't even know anything about music when I'm talking to those guys, because they have a whole other level of knowledge. And so John was in more of the different bands where they would go around playing bluegrass and walking around the park. And we weren't really in costume. We were pretty much just playing top 40.
Okay.
But yeah, John, that was a great gig, man. You know, you had healthcare with it. You had, you had all this stuff and paid really well. Yet you're in the union and everything. So not that that's great or whatever, but it's,
no, but when you're a kid, come on, man, you feel secure doing that. Of course it's good.
21, 22 years old. In Los Angeles, just like a little kid, just looking at everything and taking it in, and then making LA, instead of being afraid of it, because, like, you know, any place you move to and start over, it's pretty daunting until you get a girlfriend or you get a best friend and you start taking over that city because you know it now. It's part of you. It's not, you're not scared of it anymore. And, like, you know, people say all the time, you should move to Nashville. And if I moved to Nashville tomorrow, it'd be good for some things, but then you're starting all over, man, and the clicks and everything, any place you go, it takes you years to get there. And I have friends of mine that move here from all over the world, you know, just say, just don't give up and just keep taking any gig you can. And probably 5-6 years later, you'll see what happens, you know, but it takes a while in any city.
Yeah. You know? And how long have you been with your wife now?
25 years.
Dude, congratulations. That's a nice story.
Thank you.
Very cool. Really cool. Very cool. All righty. Let's talk David Lee Roth. Is it a safe assumption to say Billy left and then your brother recommended you? As far as how you got the gig?
Yeah. I mean, I was always, I wrote some songs for those guys when I had a publishing deal in 1985 with Polygram. So I was writing songs. I had my Akai 414s and whatever they're called, and synced them together and started writing, getting really into writing. And then I got a publishing deal and wrote a couple songs for Dave. A couple of them made them on his records and stuff. And then Billy and Dave kind of went their own ways, you know, and they needed somebody because the Skyscraper tour was coming up right after Billy left. So Greg called me and asked if I wanted to do it. And at the time I didn't really want to do it because as much as I liked that music, that wasn't really where my head was at. You know, I was kind of into different kind of stuff. So I was out on the road with Sheen Easton and doing stuff with different bands. And then I was kind of like, well, yeah, let's do it, you know? And it was great. And I'm really happy I did it, but it really wasn't where my brain was at that time. This was like 1987. And so I went down to Dave's basement and we rehearsed the show. And then it was like a whole other world, man. It was just like, I remember when my brother got the gig, I just saw his life change completely, you know. And, you know, the whole rock star thing, and I say in quotes, and it's just a life-changing experience. And at that time, it was pretty hot and, you know, pretty big deal. So,
oh, yeah.
It was an experience. There was a lot of, you know, adversity with that too, and good and bad things. And you know, for a couple of 2-3 years, it was a great job, and Dave was awesome, and he taught me a lot about, you know, entertaining and how much work it comes into just being on all the time. And great guy, and playing with Steve and Brett Tuggle and my brother, and it was just I would just be looking around going, is this really going on right now? I mean, I remember the craziest thing was my first show, because I knew, you know, you take the place of somebody like Billy. I'm always that guy that has to take some bass legends after they leave, like with Stu Hamm. It's like, you're going to play after Stu Hamm, or you're going to play after Billy. And I knew as soon as I got that gig, I could never play like Billy, because Billy's thing is, it's just amazing. And for that thing, I could never do the stuff that he did, but I know I could fit into the band, and I know I could play. And when, you know, I would just try and shed as much as I could to try and cop Billy's parts, not even getting close to what he does. But, I just had this weird feeling that something weird was going to happen. Like when I got on the first show, and I remember the first show, I was praying, I was going, God, just keep me safe and just let this go good. Sure enough, man.
Oh, so you had like a real weird feeling then.
Well, I just knew that taking his place, like with Stu's place, there's going to be people that didn't like it because it wasn't them.
Yeah, you know, I hear that. That always, like, people are really nutty about that sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't taking it too seriously because I felt pretty secure about myself, and I knew God has a plan for my life, and it was going to be okay, and I knew I was good enough to do it.
Hmm.
Not exactly like those guys, but a little different thing, and everyone's going to have their opinion. Another reason I got off of social media is that I don't really want to hear what somebody thinks about me, or what they think I can do better, you know, or what I can do or whatever. They don't like you. And when you look at yourself on social media, you find 100 nice things, and then you find that one bad thing and you focus on that one thing. So I just remember kind of going, this could get off to a rocky road. So the first show, I don't even know where it was, but the lights come down and the lights are going crazy, and Greg going nuts on the drums, and Steve's going, rah, rah, rah. And then we introduce David Lee Roth, and he walks out, runs out on stage, and he's flipping his stuff around, his nunchucks and everything. And I'm going, wow, this is a circus, man. This is like, this is nuts. Yeah. This is crazy. And we're all in our band things, and we're jumping around screaming. And whenever David pointed at it, you'd go, ah, on the mic, and you just scream, and it was like 20,000 people screaming and girls in the front row, and it's just nuts, you know. And I'm looking out while I'm singing, and as I'm singing, I'm seeing this nunchuck come flying right at my head.
It's like,
boom, and it hits me right in my strap, and it sticks to my strap, and it's going like this, you know, it's going blah 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 blah. And I'm looking at this thing, and I'm going, God, what's the deal? It's the first song. What happened, man? I'm gonna die out here. So I take nunchuck out, throw it on the ground, said a quick prayer, God help me, and it never happened again. But it was just kind of like,
wow,
what did I just walk into, and how is this going to happen every day? I mean, we used to go do, like, not, you know, Monsters of Rock and stuff like that, and literally it'd be like 120,000 people, and they would urinate in bottles and throw them on the stage because it was like, you know, rock and roll stuff. And I remember the time we played that was the show where Guns N' Roses opened up, and 5 people died because they were suffocated in the mud for that show. And then we had to go on after. And I remember they were saying, maybe we shouldn't go on. And I remember Dave said, if we don't go on, probably they're going to get more mad and more people are going to die. So you walk up on stage knowing that they're wheeling away people who have died at a rock concert.
Holy smokes.
I mean, there's stuff like that. And for me at that time, I was kind of going, as much as I loved it and it was fun and it was a good job, I was kind of looking more inward going, what is music really about? And what, you know, because I really feel like music is a gift that God has given you to glorify God, because God is pretty amazing and made music. And it's taken me a long time to figure out that I think a problem with music and the spirit of music is because as soon as you write a song, it can become about you. And, you know, in the way that the world is now, there's selfies and Self magazine and this and that, and everything points to how cool you are. Like, I used to play songs for people and look at their faces and go, that's pretty good, right? I mean, I did pretty good on that. Instead of just having God give you an idea, you write it and you go, God blessed me with that song, and it's pretty amazing. I kind of got into the me thing for years, where I had to really struggle to get out of that. And I think sometimes that's the problem with culture and the problem with where we are in the world right now, is it becomes about you, and it really shouldn't be. So at that time, I was kind of going, I don't know about music. You know, I don't know if I want to keep doing it. You know, it's fun and it's a good job, but you know, if I ever have kids, how am I going to support a kid if I decide to leave this band or that? So with Dave's thing, it was an awesome experience that I got to be great friends with Steve and all those guys and my brother and Brett and Dave and all the people that worked, the crew guys, a lot of friends and stuff. But I kind of, after a couple of years, was kind of going, you know, and music was changing anyway. I mean, you're talking 1990.
Grunge.
Directions, and so getting out of that, just going on to other things, it was good for everybody. Yeah.
Wow. So is that, how old were you then? Mid-20s?
I think by that
late time, 20s.
26, 27.
So you started thinking more, it was that time you started thinking less me-centered and more like purpose-centered.
Yeah. I mean, there's that thing, man, that it's kind of hard to explain to people that aren't musicians that whether you're playing in a top 40 band, a club band, or in front of a million people, it quickly becomes about you. It quickly becomes what it, you know, I'm singing this thing and you're listening to yourself and you can go off and it's just the human spirit. It's how we're built. We're built to be selfish and we're built to be self-glorifying. And it really takes an effort to not make it about that.
Hmm.
I do it to this day, man. I mean, I can't, you know, when we go on the road with Elton, you put your headphones, you know, your ear things in, put my hat on, my sunglasses and my suit and go out there. And the first song happens and you're automatically thinking, man, I'm pretty cool. You know, I got this gig and all these people love us, but I know why those people are there. They're not really there to see Matt Bissonette and how good he is. They're there to see Elton John. They're there to see Joe Satriani. They're good. There to see David Lee Roth. So being a sideman and being a bass player, it really humbles you down to the ground to just going, I'm just thankful to God that I'm in a band and I'm getting paid for it. And I can be on stage with these guys. And it quickly got zapped out of me, the whole me thing, because I know who I am and I know the things that I can do and how, what a bad person I can be. And I can be a good person, but majority of the time when I start thinking about myself, I just kind of get disgusted and have to constantly think what this whole thing's about, you know, it ain't about me. Well, you know, and you know, I mean, one of the cool things about, the Mustard Seeds was in this band and we were writing songs. And I remember I got married right in the beginning of it. And like most guys, you have a problem because you're dating a million girls and you're having a thing where you're having to deal with trying to do the right thing and not sleeping with every girl in town, because you know eventually you're going to die from it or you're just not going to have a great life, for me, in my view, until you settle down and you have a real marriage or a real family and stuff. So I remember, you know, because being in a band, girls check you out. They're like doing this and then you have the option to do it or not do it. And at that time, I remember, I don't even know if I told Doug this, but we got this band together and we're playing. And I was going, I started dating my wife and I'm going, okay, I got to just be with one girl for the rest of my life and shed off the past of multiple girls and other things, you know. And I prayed, God, give me something that's going to remove that thing so that I don't keep thinking about, you know, girls all the time.
It's called don't leave your house.
Exactly.
There you
so
go,
I remember, you know, Doug got in the band, George and my brother were in the band. We're playing in some club, one of the first gigs, and we're playing the gig, and this girl starts walking, beelining right up to me, and I'm thinking, she's going to hit on me and then I'm going to have to make a decision here. Walks right at me and turns left at Doug Bossy. Right to Doug. And from that point on, every girl was going after Doug. And I'm going, that's exactly what I prayed for. Even though my ego was going, what about me, man? I'm a good looking guy. What about me? But it's amazing how God works and how things happen. Not the way that you think it's going to happen, but that kind of made me just kind of wean off of that whole, what I thought life was and how you're supposed to be with girls or how you're supposed to do this and that. And it made me settle into a great marriage and just going, I love my wife and having my son. I kind of see the big picture and the right way to do it. Right. Sooner or later, everybody has to deal with that stuff. And some people don't, and maybe it works out for them. But I mean, for me, it was pretty humbling, but great at the same time. So Doug's quite the good looking guy. So,
I mean, he's a guitar player.
Exactly.
It's funny. He and I had this conversation because we got to meet in Nashville for the first time in NAMM. So we talked about some of this stuff. It was quite interesting. When you said earlier, you know, you stopped using drugs and drinking, was there like a bottom for you? Or is, I mean, if you're comfortable talking, if you're not, that's totally cool. Man,
I don't really have a story as far as like, a lot of people, when they become Christians, they go, I became a Christian because I needed an answer for my drug problem or drinking or sleeping around or pornography or whatever. And they say that faith sometimes is like a crutch, you know, it's like oxygen or something like that. I kind of relate to that and I kind of see how that works for some people. But for me, I never did draw. I probably smoked pot probably 5 times. And every time I did it, I either laughed myself to sleep or I never really got into drugs. You know, a lot of my friends were, and I saw it, but I didn't for some reason to do that, but I did like to drink. And back in Detroit, it's kind of a badge of honor to see how much beer you can drink by the time you're out of the womb.
You know? Western Pennsylvania, all that whole, you know, sort of the steel belt.
Yeah, and that goes back to the work thing, that you're working so hard that you want to reward yourself, and you go to the bar every day and you do your thing. And so I, you know, drinking from 13 years old on until I was 30 or whatever it was, that when the mustard seed started, that's when I stopped, before I got married. But it wasn't like I had any bottom thing happen, but I knew that you just don't drink and get in your car and drive. And I was miraculously saved from drunk driving tickets or, God forbid, hurting some innocent person. But, you know, everybody has their thing where they go, I got to stop. And I remember my thing was stopping with that. I mean, if we're getting personal, and I don't mind getting personal at all, it's just that I remember it was just like, why am I doing this? Why am I getting hungover and why do I feel bad? And I remember praying about it and it went away in a second. It was super, super easy. And next week would go to bars with my friends and I just didn't want to drink anymore. It just was miraculously removed because I thought maybe I was an alcoholic and I just, you know, because I like to drink. I would only drink on the weekends with my friends. I'd never drank by myself or anything like that. It just kind of went away really easily. What didn't go away super easy was girls, you know, and the feeling of needing to be wanted and coveted and even pornography, you know, growing up, you know, from 12 years old, I was around that crap big time.
Sure.
And that was the struggle where I could say that you're looking at the devil's face going, you're never going to get over this. And how do you get into a healthy marriage when you're holding on to something like that?
Yeah.
Because you're always, whether you're, you know, whatever you're doing, you're hiding the truth from the people you love. And I knew someday I'd have to deal with that. And I didn't think it was possible. And that was a little bit more difficult, but that was a miraculous thing too. To this day, the most miraculous thing in my life that I've seen God work through is just removing that in an instant too, even though it took a couple of years and stuff. So anything's possible with that stuff. It's just whether you want to do it or not. I'm kind of veering off from the point, but it wasn't like any rock bottom thing like that. It's kind of a need to just want to be a better guy. You know,
it's funny. Somebody once said, I bit my nails really badly from the time I was like 5 to, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. And I had mentioned this to, I was out with my buddy and his wife and I happened to say that. And she said, you know, Craig, it takes a lifetime to stop doing something and it takes a minute to stop doing something. And I was like, yeah, that was pretty, you know, it's funny how you, when you think of it like that, right? It's like, you know,
yeah, it goes both ways too, right?
Yeah.
You could start something so fast you don't even, you know, I mean, life is funny, man. I mean, you got to really think about what you're doing and what you're doing to other people because, I mean, any one of those days you could have been driving and then you just didn't see something when you're, you know, and it's bad enough when you're texting and driving, but being drunk and driving and you know, it could have been horrible.
No, man. Yeah. You know, you mentioned something earlier. Again, if you don't want to talk about this, that's cool. You said,
I'm not talking about my underwear
or your toenails. You said, uh, sorry, everybody listen. This is just this is a story there. You said earlier, you said, God has a plan for my life. So can I ask you a question about that? Because when you said it for like, I'm not a religious guy at all. We had this conversation. But when you said that, it struck me two ways. It's getting dark here. Can you still see me?
Oh, yeah.
Not that that's like a highlight of this, a highlight of why I hope people aren't tuning in for that.
I can see.
It struck me two ways. The one thing it struck me is like, wow, if that's a belief, that really makes rough patches in your journey a little easier. On the one hand, on the other hand, it's like, does that mean it's taking away your responsibility? Because, you know, I firmly believe that a lot of times that stuff happens to us, we have a role in it. Sometimes you don't. You get sick, you know, assuming you didn't abuse your body or whatever, that's not your fault. You know, somebody, a loved one dies, that's not your fault. But a lot of times, you know, we just make stupid decisions and shit catches up with us. You know, it doesn't have to be drugs. I mean, anything, you know, could be you're neglecting fixing your tire or something like that and you get into an accident. So I just wanted to get like your thoughts on that. On the one hand, it makes it easy because if you're saying that God has a plan for me, well, or whatever, you know, God represents to whoever's listening to this, versus, you know, how much of that is just taking it off for you. I just was curious. I want to get your thoughts on, I mean, I'm not questioning you. I want your thoughts really on my question about this, really.
No, well, it's a great question. And I mean, we're on a guitar show talking about things that I think are more important than guitar. God bless the bass, but what is it all anyway?
Right.
What is this whole thing about? And for me, it's kind of like this, 50-50, right? There either is a God that really runs everything, that really is truth, or there isn't. And if there isn't, then you live your life, you die, and there's nothing after. So there's really no reason to be accountable. There's no really reason to not just do anything you want. And just, you could be selfish. I have tons of atheist friends that are probably better Christian living people than some Christians that I know.
Sure.
But if it is true, if God made everything and there's a plan for our lives after we die, that means when we die, we go to heaven to be with God forever. If there's any chance of that being true, I want that. And I challenge anybody, even my best atheist friends, the question of, if it could be true, wouldn't you want that at the end of your life when you die? You're going to go someplace to be with your family, to be with people you loved, or to be with, more importantly, to be with God forever. That your life here, 50, 60, 70, 80, 10 years, whatever it is, that there is a plan for that, that you're just not built to just be successful here and to make music and to write a few good songs and to be famous and everything that comes with that. Because, I mean, I've been blessed to work with really talented, famous people. You know, and it always comes to the same thing, that no matter how successful you are, once you start being successful, you always want to be successful and you always want to outdo your next record. And
if you're driven, yeah.
Yeah, you're driven. And most.
Yeah, you don't get there by not being driven. It's not random, right? Like, oh, this lazy, you know, SOB became a superstar. Yeah.
100% of the people that I've worked with that are successful are driven to the max, because you can't do it without that.
Yeah.
And every person I've worked, like Rick Springfield, amazingly talented guy. He works harder than anybody I've ever seen. He goes out on the stage and he's pretty much on the ground by the end of the show. But when I look at my life, I go, I'm a musician that has played with famous people. I'm not giving that 110 drop dead every night. I'm playing on a stage with somebody supporting that person, because Rick is a rock star. You know, Dave's and Joe, Elton, these guys are rock stars, and they're just different than most of us. They want to fulfill every night like it's the last show of their life. And they, I'm just looking at, like, Elton's 72, 73 years old. He'll play something. He plays it different every night. Every show, he plays every song differently. He'll play a lick and he'll look at me. And I'll go, that was really good. He needs me to tell him that he's great, that he's doing a great job. And I'm like going, well, that kicks my butt because I should be doing the same thing. I should be giving it everything I have, you know? And all these guys have earned what they have because they are rock stars, you know? Yeah. But when I look at that too, I also go, at the end of that, you know, there's that famous story, then what, you know? So the guy grows up and goes, what do you want to be? I want to be a artist. Then what? Well, then I want to be known by everybody. Then what? Then I want to have a family and have people, you know, then what? Then what? All the way down the line until I'm 90 years old and then I die. And then what? You know, that's the question for me. Then what? And the life I'm living now, I can't see any other way than there's a hand of God that's making me, first of all, being even able to have five fingers and being able to play music. Because I really shouldn't, because I'm not smart enough. It just happened. And then all these jobs that have come, Matt, all these things that line up.
I buy that. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, man. You just left. I was just so wide open, man.
For me, it just, the 50-50 thing is on God's side, because I just can't see it any other way. So yeah. I just think that we're all, you know, you can say it's old fashioned and nowadays it's tough to talk about it, but I really believe what the Bible says, that from Adam and Eve all the way down, we're born as sinful people that are trying to not be sinful people. It's not like we're born great and that it's easy. You know, the first thing a baby says is mine, 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 mine. Why is that? We're born with selfishness. We have to fight to not be selfish. We have to learn to get along with people. So it's not natural. So this life we have, however long it is, we spend our time, in my view, trying to be good people only because God is, you're accountable to God that makes you want to be a better person. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but that's kind of how I look at it.
No, I was just, you did answer. I was curious what your viewpoint was on that, because all this is I find it. No, I find it really interesting. And I, you know, I'm always looking for ways to, be in a sense less accountable, because I think for me, I put too much accountability on myself, which is a weird thing in the sense of sometimes shit just happens.
Right. Well, you know what? I was just reading about this yesterday. If God is real, you really don't have anything to worry about, because you can only be so responsible. You can only dot so many I's to right. do your of what it is. And the whole purpose of Jesus was, he says, I came here to forgive you because you can't be perfect. You know, I like that because I am not perfect.
Yeah, right. None of us
I
are.
I need forgiveness. And it's a daily thing, man. You're married for 25 years. You don't not know how to say you're sorry or forgive me. You need that. And I need to get off my pedestal of thinking that I'm perfect and learn that I'm not. And I think that helps me with what you're talking about, because yeah. I know, you know, stuff happens to you. Stuff happens to everybody.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What you do with that. And I think with God, having a relationship with God, it takes the seriousness off of not performing 100% all the times, having an off time where I don't do the right thing. But to identify what you do and, you know, be forgiven about it. I mean, being forgiven is a big thing. I mean, you forgive mostly for yourself because,
right.
you know, you don't want to hold that stuff. People die of cancer from unforgiveness, you know? And yeah. So I think I kind of get what you're saying. And I think that by having a relationship with God, it's taken the pressure off of me of trying to do everything on my own.
And, well, that's what I was getting at. Yeah. It seems like that's like it. If as long as you're given 110% and like you just say, well, you're not being willful on the outcome, sort of, you know?
Oh, yeah, man. I have no control over the outcome.
Yeah.
Pretty much 90% of the time. And when they do happen for the good, I'm pleasantly surprised. You know, low expectations, that whole thing. You know,
sure.
I'm getting drafted. I mean, he got passed over his junior year of college, and I pretty much said, he really wants this. I wanted to see my son do something he wants to
do.
When he got passed over the first year, it was the toughest year for me because I'm thinking, next year the same thing's going to happen, and he's going to be a senior. What's going to happen? God, are you not – you know, honoring our wishes for our son to play. What's wrong with you, God? Why aren't you answering everything I ask of you? You know, what makes you go to that level? Because you're just human, you know, you want your kid to do well. And when he did get drafted, it was like somebody just poured an ice cream sundae on my life and just said, you get this too.
Yeah.
And that's, you can't determine outcome. You can just put the work in and hope for the best.
Right. And that's what I've kind of learned. I've kind of surrendered a lot of that over the last few years. And
What else can you do?
Right. And it's just been, I find it's been a lot easier. And it's a difficult, but it's been easier in the sense of, you know, like I'm only responsible for my end, sort of, you know, and that's all I could be held accountable for. And I think I tended to put unrealistic accountability on myself. You know, I can't be responsible for the consequences. I could just be responsible for what I do, you know, and if it doesn't work out or if something doesn't happen, I want, you know, that's it, man. You got to move on.
Sounds like you're right where you should be. I mean, that's what more can you do?
Yeah, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for going down that road. I want to switch back to music. Funny enough. I'm going to mention a few guys. You already talked about Rick. How did you get the gig with them? And can you talk about a cooler, interesting story about working with them? Let's talk about Ringo.
Well, real quick, getting back to Rick before then.
Yeah.
I remember when the Mustard Seeds, we were going like 92 to 98, something like that. And when we split up, we all kind of went our ways to work and do whatever we could. And I remember my brother and I auditioned for Don Henley, and we were going to get the gig, and then something happened at the last minute where we didn't do it. And then the bass player for Don, they got the gig with Don, was playing with Rick Springfield, and he told me about Rick's gig, so they called me, and I went out with Rick. And then I played in Rick's band for 12 years, whatever, and we got to be really good friends, and we produced and co-produced like three records together that were some of the best music I think I've ever done in my life. It was awesome. But at that time,
so, interrupt you 1 second. Was George playing with him then?
Well, first of all, George, you know, like we all do. I remember there was a year when the Mustard Seeds broke up that we just had my son. He was 2 years old. And I'm going, what am I? I was making $150 a week total for supporting the family. So I would do drum cartridges for my brother and it'd make $250. I'd show up to sessions with musicians who I've played with ever since I moved to LA, and they go, oh, I didn't know you were on this. And I'm going, well, I'm setting up my brother's drums.
Wow.
Wow. So that's what I mean, man. You have to humble yourself.
I give you credit to do. I mean, I would have done the same thing, man. You got to eat, you got to support a family. I'd do anything I have to do, but good on you.
With Elton, I could be done tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have a problem putting the Lyft, the Uber thing on my car and driving people.
Yeah.
As long as I'm doing my job and supporting my family. That was a tough time for my ego, but it was another adversity thing that was good for me.
Yeah.
Even though I was probably making more money than some of these guys that were playing the sessions, you know?
Right.
I remember in August lugging up the drums and stuff like that. I didn't really know what I was doing. George was doing the same thing with Rick. He started out being
He told me that. By the way, for people listening, I'm talking about George Bernhardt. He played with Rick Springfield. I interviewed him a while ago. Great guy. Great interview. So check it out. I'm sorry. Sorry, man.
Doug and George, and I mean, Doug's done the same thing. He's gone on to playing his guitar, but he's also got into the music business of placements and stuff.
Licensing,
like that.
Yeah.
He's always been brilliant at that stuff, and I was always telling him, man, you got to use these gifts, you know? And so George was doing the teching with Rick, and then Dave Whiston, the guitar player, left to do something else, and then George took over, and he played with him for a while. We had a band with George Bernhardt, Roger Carter, the drummer for Rick, and me called the Squirts, and we would open up for Rick.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember he told me that.
Our CDs and stuff. It would be kind of like a glorified sound check for Rick, so then we came up there, you know. And George would play guitar on all three of those records, and it was just a great relationship with Rick. He's a great guy, and just amazing. So, but when I was with Rick, sometimes Rick would take some time off. He took the first time off to do the show in Vegas. And then I went, started recording with Joe again and started doing, and I got to do like four or five more records with Joe while I was playing with Rick, kind of moonlighting, and Lance would come back and play bass sometimes with Rick. And it was great with Rick because I could do other gigs. That's when,
funny how that works. You went from doing Cartage and like barely scraping by. Now you're on Satriani's gig. You're on Rick's. It's crazy, isn't it?
Role, because it went while I was with Rick, I did three or four tours with Joe, three or four records. We did the ELO thing, and then we did the Ringo thing. So with Ringo, he had a band called Ringo and the Roundheads with Mark Hudson. He was the musical director, and he was working in the sessions with Greg, and then he put us in the band. So we would do the Jay Leno shows, Conan, and all that stuff when Ringo would have a new album. And then we did a live DVD called Ringo and the Roundheads, which is all over YouTube and stuff. So with Rick, it was the perfect gig because I started doing all this other stuff, you know, and it all kind of worked out. And Rick wasn't bummed when I'd go off and do that. And then we started doing more records together with Rick. And then around that time, we were traveling so much with Rick. And this is another crazy thing. I remember I was just getting kind of fried and I kind of wanted to do something else. As much as I liked playing with Rick, I was just kind of just wanted to do something else. And I remember going into my bedroom, getting on my knees and praying, God, can you give me some gig that I could make a bunch of money on and just do something different for a while? And I don't want to be called to playing Green Day because I don't want to be like Moses there. I want to gig, and I don't want to be the oldest guy.
So, that's a lot of requirements you got there, Matt. Yeah. That's a big request to be fulfilled.
55 years old or whatever I was at the time. I mean, there's not that many gigs where you're not the oldest guy. So then lo and behold, a couple weeks later, our good friend Bob Birch passed away. And they called me and they said, we want you to do this gig. I didn't have to audition, didn't do anything. It just kind of worked. I was at Davey Johnstone's house. And he just goes, I want you to do this. And I got the gig with Elton and I was the youngest guy in the band.
There you go, man.
So the power of prayer, I mean, I can't say enough about it. And it's kind of weird to say this story being that one of my good friends that I grew up with in Detroit, Bob Birch, passed away.
Sure.
But I have a feeling, and I talked to his wife right when it happened, right when he died, and she said he would want you to do this gig, you know.
So that's great.
Felt a little weird at first. I learned got the tape from his last show, from Bob's last show, wrote out every lick he played, paid some guys to write it out. And I learned exactly what he played to make it easy for these guys transitioning who were grieving Bob's death. Tried to just come in there and make it as much as normal could be for them. And crazy thing, the first show we played, Elton was looking behind me. He had this terrified look on his face. And he told me, he goes, when you were playing, I saw Bob's ghost behind you.
Wow. Probably because you had gotten all those licks down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly the real reason. I had a picture of Bob on his bass because I just used his basses and tried to make it so that the show would go on. And by the third show, Elton called me and said, appreciate everything that you're doing. You sound great. Just play whatever you want to play because this is a new thing. And that's the thing with Elton. He's always into some other new music and into something else. He just goes, just play what you want. So gave me the green light to just do whatever I wanted. And in 7 years of almost 8 years of being with him, he's only told me two things. He goes, just play a little bit less on this song, Take Me to the Pilot.
I love that song, man.
Yeah.
That's old Elton. I love that.
Yeah, and that's that and one other song. And, I mean, come on, man.
To have that kind of freedom.
Yeah, and it's not like he's going to go every day, you sounded great, man. You're fantastic. But the pat on the back with him is that you're still in the band.
Yeah.
You know, the next day, there's not somebody else taking your place. So,
That's freaking awesome, man. Frampton. I didn't know you were out with Frampton.
Well, I never toured with Peter. Around that time with Dave, after I left Dave, I was writing a lot still with Polygram, and they put us two together to write.
You and Peter.
Martin Grombach, the drummer from Pat Benatar. So we jammed and we wrote some songs and stuff like that, but we never toured together. But it kind of always shows up. And WikiLeaks or whatever it is.
Wikipedia. Julian Lennon.
Yeah, I did. Bob Ezrin produced his record with Saltwater and Help Yourself, I think the album was called. So we recorded for a month and got to hang out with him. We'd go play darts at the British pub and stuff. And just one of those things where it was like a month hangout, then I never saw him again. Yeah.
Was Steve Hunter on that record as well?
Steve, I met Steve when he was helping Jason out from doing Dave Lee Roth's record. We were in a hotel in Vancouver doing the record, and Jason had just got diagnosed with disease. And Steve is a doctor, you know, he administers shots. He's, you know, a brilliant guy. And he would play the parts that Jason couldn't get his fingers around because he was starting to get his fingers were going numb and stuff like that. So I remember being in my hotel room, and I remember looking, I was right across the hall from Jason, and Jason was just sitting there with a needle. He had to put it in his side, and he just couldn't get the guts up to do it, you know? And I remember that's when things just started spiraling for Jason. And I remember Steve would give him shots.
Yeah.
And we'd all be kind of hanging around with him. And Steve, I think Steve did play on that record. Yeah.
With Julian. Yeah, because I know he played with Julian. He was he learned all that in the service. He was like a doctor in the service. He was actually an X-ray tech, I think is what it was. But he did a lot of other stuff.
Man.
Awesome dude.
Man, great guy.
Yeah. Hey, what are the top 3 experiences, if you could even answer that, that you've had musically and for any reason at all? It could be, you know, not have to be a big gig or, you know, whatever, just something that 3 things that come to your mind right away.
I talked about this one thing on some other stuff. I remember one thing, Maynard taught this major lesson one time. We were playing, you know, we were 20 years old on the road with Maynard. We're out on the road, kind of figuring it out. And then one night we played in Cincinnati at Riverfront Stadium at this jazz festival. It was like 50,000 people there.
That's massive. Yeah. Riverfront. That's where the Reds play.
Yeah. It was awesome. And we were just like playing and just going, wow, people are loving us. This is so great, you know? And then we got on a bus and we drove to Denver or something. I think it was up someplace in the mountains in Colorado. And it was snowing like crazy. We barely got up the hill. We got to the gig. It was so snowed out that there was only like 25 people there. Nobody could get to the 25 people there. And we were all kind of going, oh man, you know, we played Riverfront Stadium last night. We were like, you know, the stuff. And, you know, and Maynard was watching us and he pulled a meeting and he goes, guys, you guys just played Riverfront Stadium in front of all these people and you did a good job. But this is the show that we're going to sound the greatest on, because we're going to play for these people. And this is going to be the best night. And it was. We played for these 25 people and they loved it. And we were just playing amazing that night. And Ron Pedley, the piano player, and I looked at each other and go, that is a lesson. That a guy he was 65 years old at the time or whatever, has been playing all these places, done all these experiences. And he realized he could tell in his troops that they were grumbling and already getting a little whacked up the ladder about, you know, self-perception and stuff. That was an amazing thing to this day when I play. If I'm, you know, I played a gig a couple of years ago with this girl singer and her name is Yvonne Perea, really talented singer. And I was so tired just from different things that I remember I was sitting on a stool and I was playing and then I kind of nodded off and I had drool flying down and the drummer's just looking at me laughing. And he started playing and he nudged me with the stick and I look up at him and it's like coming down. I'm going, I don't ever want to get that comfortable. If I'm that tired, I shouldn't be there. But the thing with Maynard really made me kind of realize that you're not playing so much for the people, you're playing for each other. You're playing as the band and you need to be there for each other, you know? And that's something like with a band like Kansas, you know, I saw the documentary on them and everybody did their job, you know, everybody played their part. Nobody went off every night playing, check me out, check my licks out. It was like this organized greatness of every piece fits, you know, when you're writing and you have a song like Carry On My Wayward Son, those parts are there, you know, you just don't jam because you feel like it, you know? So that's all kind of that Maynard lesson of you just play for each other and it's a team, you know? As far as other experiences, there's been so many things that I can't really, I know I had a list that you gave me and I was trying to wing it and stuff. I'm not really, you know, things are popping in my head, but there's just been millions of little things like that. You know,
that's cool, man. Very, very cool.
I didn't do my homework. Sorry.
No, it's all good, man. There is no homework, no homework at all. Is there any advice, if you had to go and look back, advice that you'd have given your younger self that would have made your life easier, professionally, personally, any areas you want?
I would have, like, when I talk to young people that even want to know or want to have a conversation, for me, I would have started writing way earlier. And I would have, I mean, now kids are playing guitar, bass, drums, everything themselves. They got their Pro Tools stuff, you know, but they don't have the experience that we had, because there's not that much experience to go out and play as there was back then. But I'd probably tell myself, you know, practice more, you know, but I feel pretty good about balance. You know, I think the main thing in life is balance. You can't just be a great musician and a crappy person or vice versa. You got to have things that are more important than music and which there are, and you got to find those things and do those things so that it makes music more enjoyable, you know? So I would just say, if I could have learned to sing and write earlier, that probably would have helped me to be more successful with that. And it's a lot more fun writing songs than just playing bass or just playing guitar or anything and learning, you know, I play a little bit of guitar on my songs and stuff. And I wish I could have done that a little bit earlier. And I wish in life in general, I hadn't wasted years just drinking and carousing and doing stupid stuff that, you know, when you go to a bar, when you're a kid, you're spending 6 hours a night trying to pick up girls and you're going, that's 6 hours of your life.
You know? Yeah, I know that you don't think of that at the time. That's like if someone told you that age, hey, you know, you should put money in an IRA. Yeah, you know, it's just not something that you could process, you know, you can't compute. Yeah. It does not compute at that point, man.
The things that are gone now and you can't take them back, but
yeah.
Do it again. I probably not a whole lot I'd do differently because I'm you know, however you get to where you are is because of where you've gone through. So I
feel good. Desert Island. Oh no, favorite guitar players that you've enjoyed playing with. Don't have to be the best, just favorites that you've enjoyed playing with.
Hmm. Well, Joe always comes to mind because he can do anything. I mean, he did the what was the band Joe played? Deep Purple. He'd go out and play with Deep Purple. Then he'd go out and, you know, Joe was great because it wasn't like he wrote songs. I know you guys talked about this a little bit on the podcast. He wouldn't just write songs and play a different solo every night. He'd play the exact solo from the record.
Yeah.
You know, like when you go see a band and you go hear your favorite song and the guy is riffing on the hook of the song, you're going, I came here, paid money to hear that song.
Right.
You know, you forget that sometimes as a musician because you think that people want to hear what you have to offer about how your vocabulary is and you can play stuff, when really people want to just hear what the song is. That's what Joe does with these difficult solos. I mean, he really taught me about you just don't wing it because you could get lost in the middle of a solo of his solos because they're so crazy. So his musicologist outlook on everything, he kind of taught me that everything has its place, you know, that team thing of, you know, when I record with Joe, I wouldn't just jam. I would just play what the song needed, you know. I love playing with Joe. I love playing with Steve I. He's great, you know, for that kind of guitar playing. There, you know, I don't think there's anybody better. Then there's guys like guys that I've played top 40 bands with. I remember playing with Dwayne Bailey, who later on went to play with Chicago. We're playing top 40 clubs and just singing and playing. And I really love guitar players that can sing and play. And you know, guys like John Jurgensen, Davey Johnstone from Elton's band. Davey plays stuff when we're in the studio with Elton that I don't think anybody else could ever play because he knows Elton so much that he knows exact weird tunings, you know, just amazing amount of tunings and different things, you know, guys, and just guys that have music vocabulary. I mean, you know, Doug and George, you know, just amazing guitar players and singers and just great guys, you know. So, I mean, there's a countless amount of guys I could go on for days. And I know we don't have that long, unless you want to call me back.
Desert Island Discs. What's your top three? Just give me your knee-jerk reaction for right
top
now.
Top three.
Desert Island Discs, like, you know, favorite records, three favorite records. Just for now. I mean, this could, you know, obviously this could change in 20 minutes.
It could. Well, my first solo album. No, just kidding.
That was great.
I remember album covers mostly from opening them up at Christmas back in Detroit. I remember getting the Boston album with Smokin' on it.
Yeah, it's a good record, man.
That album killed me when I first got it. Then there's like certain jazz records, like Chick Corea Friends. That album still played all the time. A lot of jazz records like that. And then probably Kansas, you know, probably the original one with Carry On My Wayward Son.
Left Overture.
Yeah, Left Overture. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good record.
Yeah, I mean, those are the first three that pop in my mind. I mean, for me, it's kind of hard to answer that question because there's certain pockets of time. Because I grew up on jazz, rock, fusion, funk, everything at the same time, that question I could answer is, what's my top three funk records?
Sure. You
know? And, you know, it's kind of hard to, it's like your ugly sister picking your, whatever that saying goes.
No, it is. It's a ridiculously tough.
Then why'd you ask it?
Because you're a tough guy and you can rise up to the occasion, Matt. Most important thing you've learned, or most important things you've learned about yourself?
Definitely not to take myself too seriously, and that humility through experience and through things in life has taught me that to never expect too much. And when you do that, you never get disappointed, and just stay focused on the job. You know, like one thing I do like about myself, is that it's a funny way to say it, is just seeing a job. Like I'm doing some vocals upstairs here. We're in Big Bear, California right now, and our house is being sold. So I brought up all my gear here because I can't sing in a hotel room that we're staying in. So I've got to sing some songs for this friend of mine, David Wallerstein, who has a band, and I'm singing lead vocals with Simon Phillips, the drummer.
Oh, wow.
So I brought my stuff up there and singing upstairs. But it's really hard because it's like 20 part harmony stuff and lead vocals and everything. And it takes like 8 hours to do it. And I know today when we get done, I'm going to go up there and go, this is the job. By 9 o'clock tonight, I have to get these vocals done. And it's hard work and singing everything and punching yourself in on the computer. But I know when I get it done, that work ethic of Detroit will be, you did your job. So when I get my check, I go, I worked my butt off for this. But this is what you get for this, and this is what you get for that. And you don't get that unless you do the work, you know? So,
you like your work ethic.
I like having a job to do, and I like doing a job that somebody tells you, you did a great job, and the money I spent on you was well spent. You serve your boss. I mean, you know, it's the chain of command. I mean, I serve God. I want God to say to me at the end of my life, the famous saying, well done, faithful servant. I want to get a check from Joe Satriani that he's not giving to me going, you know, thanks, man. It's not what I wanted. I want Joe. I'm really happy to give you this check, you know?
Yeah, totally.
That's what it's about. You do your job and you want to serve your boss, you know? That's kind of my
thing. Flip side, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would that be?
I don't know, man. It's I'm just really happy that I'm not a rock star. I'm really happy that I'm not the center of attention all the time. And my line is in my life, I just want to be famously unknown, where people kind of respect you and they know who you are, but you're not at a restaurant where somebody comes up and asks you to sign their face, you know, or something that. Because the people that I do work with that are super famous, it's a chore, man, and it takes your life and it takes away a lot. I mean, sure, it's great for a lot of things, but it's difficult to be that, you know? And so I'm thankful for the path that I was on and where I am and that I can do whatever I want when I want to. So there's not a whole lot I would want to change, you know, besides taking some of the stupid things and hurting people when I've done, you know, things that I've done that I can't, you know. Yeah. you can only ask for forgiveness and move on and try and make reprimands with those people while you're still here. You know, find those people that you've wronged and tell them you're sorry. And most of the time, they don't even remember what you did.
Yeah, man, they have no clue. I had a funny you say that, man. I was mean to this girl when I was a kid. A girl of all things. How pathetic is that? And she contacted me on Facebook and I said, hey, you know, she said, oh, I'm nice to see you. I said, listen, I really just want to apologize to you. I said, it was kind of mean to you. And she said, you know, that's really, I said, you know, but I had some stuff going on at home. It was not an excuse, but I'm just telling you that, you know, I wasn't in a good place. So I'm really sorry. And she said, you know, I never even thought of it. But thank you. It's very kind of you. You know, it was like, but I, you know, for me, oh, I felt like a weight of the world lifted on my shoulders. It was like, oh my.
I was at my son's game last year. Josh used to play on Baylor, and they played Oklahoma in Baylor. And I always sit behind home plate, and I have my own spot so that I could just, because I only could see my son in certain times because I've been on the road, and I would just sit there. The parents kind of knew to kind of leave this guy alone. Cut the time as much as I can, of, you know, and I was sitting there by myself, nobody around me. And this Oklahoma fan, older guy, comes in, sitting next to me, just whistling and strike that bum out, you know, and just kind of going off in his southern drawl, you know. And I can't really move from this guy. And my son's coming to bat next. My son comes up and strikes out. And the guy stands up and goes, sit down, man, sit down, put your butt on the bench. And I'm like, and I grabbed him and I go,
yeah, you got to say, yeah.
I go, what's your problem, man? This isn't even your field. He goes, well, what's your problem? And we went at it, you know, didn't do anything weird, but I said, man, you got a lot of nerve, you know, kind of got mad at him. And I walked away and he walked away. And next day we're playing the same team and he's sitting down in the front. And I hear this voice, and that's how I know there's a God, because this doesn't make any sense in the world. And I would say the Holy Spirit tapped me on the shoulder and goes, you walk over to that guy and apologize. And I go, but I don't want to. It was his fault. He was a jerk. I don't care. I want you to go apologize. I'm going, no, I'm not going to do that. And sure, I'm looking at my feet and I'm walking towards the guy. And I tapped him on the shoulder and he looked at me like super scared and super mad. And I just go, man, I'm so sorry about that. I was having a tough day. My son was, you know, having a tough day. Guy starts crying. He goes, I felt so bad about this for 24 hours. I've been thinking about it all night.
Wow.
And thank you for saying that. And
so you hugged it out and that was it?
Yeah, that's it.
That's good, man.
You know, and you can, you know, walk away from that stuff before you apologize and stuff it in yourself and go, I forget that that happened, but it did happen.
Yeah.
And you never know your effect. Maybe that guy could eventually go and die or kill themselves over that situation. I mean, you never know. You never know what your effect is on people. So whenever you can, just try and make that right. You know, but totally. I mean, when the guy was crying, I was like, you made me cry.
Yeah.
You know, anyway.
Wow. So everybody make sure that you irritate Matt if you see him, because you know, you have a moment the next day together.
It won't take much to irritate me.
Hey man, I got to tell you, I would have done the same thing. I don't know if I would have said, hey, listen, man, that's my son. You know, can you just back off? You know, it was totally called for. I mean, that was just rude. You know,
you just don't know what you're capable of until a situation happens and you're amazed at how brilliant you can act. And you can really, really do things that you so bad you can't imagine. You know, I mean, like my dog, we were at home and he got taken by a coyote right in front of me.
Oh my God.
Dragged across the street, and I chased him down and caught him and saved him, right? This guy from the coyote started coming after me, and I lost who I was and became the superhero for about 20 seconds. And my wife was just saying she saw me running up the street, and I don't even remember any of it besides after it was done, I broke my ankle chasing him. I'm in the hospital going shaking, and it's kind of like, you know, you're getting the adrenaline's wearing off.
Yeah.
Going, what did I just do? That same thing can happen in a bad way where you just react. You know, I'm sure a lot of murderers didn't know they were going to do that when they woke up, and it just, things happen, you know?
Man, it's funny you say that. I saw this special on Netflix. It happened. It took place in England. It's called Just One Punch. It's like a short little documentary about that these people just went off the cuff and they killed somebody.
and the rest of your life is
destroyed.
We're talking about guitars here,
Matt. Three more questions, and I can't. I could talk to you all night, man. You're just awesome. You have any hobbies outside of music or interests?
I love coming up to Big Bear and walking around in the forest and wrestling bears and all that stuff. Just forcing myself to get away from the hamster wheel. You know, I love doing work, but I love trying to balance it out with other things. I mean, I love sports, playing anything, tennis and softball now because I'm older. I can't play baseball. But playing softball and any kind of sport, doing stuff like that. I love going to see when I'm on the road. I love seeing movies, you know, and just going, like when we were in Europe for 3 months, I try and walk 15 to 20 miles a day, probably 10 to 15 miles a day.
That's great, man.
Just try and keep moving. You know, I mean, you get older, you see these guys in the park with the whole Tai Chi thing or whatever they're doing. It's a lesson that you just got to keep moving. So yeah. I always find the farthest movie theater I could and then walk there, watch the movie, eat the popcorn and the Coke that you just burned from the walk, and turn around and come back. So you have a destination, you have a point to get to and a goal for that day. Because on the road with Elton now, it's like we have a lot of days off and you can just sit in a room or you can move around.
Yeah.
So keep moving. Anything to do with, you know, just talking to people, you know, and hanging out with people and trying to be a good guy. Try to finish strong.
You're doing all right, man.
You are.
Thank you. Working at it. Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
You know, if I had read the list and consumed it, I'd have a pat answer for that. Lazy and disgruntled. Hardest decision.
Yeah. Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do? Besides answer these questions.
Oh, man, you know, a bunch of things popped in my mind because there's a lot of things that, you know, I remember when the mustard seed, I had it in my life, in my mind that after I was out on the road with Joe, Greg and I came back to LA and we were going to start our own band, the Mustard Seeds. And Greg made it about a year and then he was like, I can't do this anymore. It's just too tough to be in a, just do one thing. Because when you're in a band, you can't, if you're really going to be, you know, at the time the Mustard Seeds happened, the grunge thing happened. And here we are, this band of guys that love to play and learn their instruments. And now, and there's harmonies, there's like King's X harmonies. King's X was a huge favorite of us. And we wanted to be like that and be proficient at what we played. But then music changed on a dime.
Yeah.
Everything that came out of LA was lame. You know, it's like it has to be from this area or this area. And grunge is great. I mean, it's amazing, but it's a whole spirit of music that's different than we were at. And we knocked our heads for 10 years with that band trying to become like everything. And we had a great time doing it. And it was fun. And it was just hard, hard work. I remember when the band finally went its own way, you kind of realize, okay, now I'm married. I have a kid. And I need to be responsible and start joining the workforce. And I remember trying to get a job at FedEx. They said, "We'll show up at 5 a.m. I'm like, "Nah, that ain't gonna work." I know I have to make money with my instrument because that's all I can do. That's all I really need to do. So I think it was really hard to just kind of come to terms with, I'm not gonna just write songs and be in a band that I want to be proud of. I'm gonna have to do a little bit of everything, which has worked out great because I've got to have a bunch of different relationships with bands. And looking back now, I go, maybe that was the plan all along. You know, I mean, the main thing with the Mustard Seeds was it made me a better writer and it made me learn how to write with other people and to coexist with them and, you know, made me a better person. So I can't think of anything that was like devastating that would make me, you know, change course or do anything differently. You know? So I'm grateful for that.
And I just want to tell everybody listening, if you haven't checked out the Mustard Seeds, this is just a phenomenal, the level of musicianship, the level of writing, the mastering, the engineering. I mean, it's just freaking, I mean, first class. This is unusual to have that high.
Awful nice of you to say.
Oh man, it's that high proficiency level.
We were kind of a victim at the time of not having budgets or anything. We did the first record on our little 12 track, you know, 8 track put together, and we'd engineered ourselves. And I don't know what I'm doing with that stuff. George is really good at it.
Yeah, George, I remember. Yeah,
George is brilliant at that stuff. But we kind of, it was just strange timing with that band, you know, and just music and everything changed. And I listened back to the records, and I'm really proud of them. And just every song brings back some memory, and just grateful to be in a band like that with such great guys.
Oh, just first class, proficient. I mean, and not just proficient technically, really melodic, great writing, man. It was just phenomenal. Really good stuff, man.
That means a lot. Maybe it's all for that. We would always tell ourselves, you know, if we could change one life, all that work would be worth it.
And there you did.
And you never know. You never know with anything you do anyway, but looking back now, I'm just so glad we did it.
Yeah. And if you ever, I would love that Mustard Seeds 4, man. We launch it right on this show, man. That would be awesome. And last question. And man, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed talking to you. You're a wonderful guy. You're very warm and sincere. And I really appreciate all of those things about you. So thank you.
Man, I love you, man. I want to come to that. Doug told me about the show a while ago, and I was kind of going, he goes, you should do the show. And I was going, well, you know, I'm a bass player, it's a guitar show, and I mean, it's got strings and everything. But sometimes I look at my life and I don't really have anything that's interesting that I really feel like I want to, that's really anybody would want to listen to, because it's really just the normal life, you know. I mean, it's gone through ups and downs and different curves and stuff, and I'm very thankful for my life. But sometimes, I mean, I get off of social media just because I can't, like, for your fate, you know, for your webpage, it's like, you're trying to make it sound like someone else is writing about it. And I went out on the road with blah blah blah, and you're really going, I'm really writing that about myself, even though you're paying someone to do it and representing yourself like that. It's always kind of been odd to me, like, you know, I'm very thankful for the life that I've had and the way that it's gone. But to me, it doesn't seem like any different story than anybody else. So I was kind of like, why would I want to go on a show and tell people about what they've gone? You know, everyone's gone through their thing, you know. But when Danny told me about it too, he said, you should do it. And I was like, and I watched, you know, listened to your show a few times, and it was really cool. And I didn't want to, you know, hopefully people listen to it and get something out of it.
No, of course they will. Are you kidding me? Everybody's got a unique story. Everybody's story is different. Everybody's path is different. We're all kind of the same, but how everybody's affected, I think, is different. And it's really inspiring to hear, you know, the things that also move, for me anyway. And I think for a lot of listeners, it's inspiring to hear the different things that move different people. And I think people, there's always something, with rare exception, that someone can relate to, because we're all, you know what, look, we're all doing the same thing. We're trying to get through the day, get some crap off our plate, maybe be a better person, be less of a jerk, you know?
Well, God bless you for doing the show, man. It's a great show, and you have great people on it. And it's like a community. That's what we are.
Yeah. It? Yeah. It's a really great community, man. That's exactly what it is. It's a community, man. That's exactly what it is. It's awesome. But you're not going to get away from answering this last question. So let me ask you. biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, Matt, and how much of this has been intentional and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, I mean, I've always been kind of a jokester and kind of a wacky guy and stuff. And life has a way of possibly beating it out of you if you don't fight it. So I am trying to, as much as I can, to not hyper focus on little details in life, because there's always one more detail, you know, especially moving like we are. You got to be kidding me. You know, it's like always one more thing, you know. And I had a point in my head, and things are getting, I'm getting older now, things are flying out. But it's really about, I know what it is. I heard a sermon the other day. This guy, Chuck Smith, who was an amazing pastor, said, joy and peace isn't something that should come and go. What comes and goes is happiness because of events that happen through the day. You know, like, you can be, there's a guy who buys a new car. I'm so happy that I just bought this car. Oh no, I just slammed my car against the railing and now I have to have AAA come and get it. Now I'm bummed out. But now the insurance company is giving me more money than I have. I'm happy now. but now I have to buy a new car and I'm sad now. I mean, it's a constant up and down with life. And I think that peace that God gives you, which is the default, I think that he wants us to have, is no matter your circumstances, that peace and joy is always there. It may go up and down because of your circumstances, but to be secure in who you are, not that you're great or bad or whatever, but that God has given you this life, however many years, and you just are thankful. If you're in a state of thankfulness, and for me recently, just in my own life in the last couple of weeks, been thinking about this a lot, that if God does exist and he has a plan for my life, and I'm thankful for whatever it is, how bad can it be? You know, I mean, people are going to die. I'm going to die. My dog, who's upstairs right now, who's been amazing for this whole time, is going to pass away. It's just the natural thing. The planet isn't miraculously going to start becoming better. Everything is, I mean, you should be conscious of throwing your garbage away. You should do the things you got to do. You should love your neighbor. But eventually, things are built to go. That's not a reason to be mad at God. That's what God told us is going to happen. So being thankful in the middle of that and being grateful, you can't really be too bummed about with whatever you're dealt, you know? I mean, I could smash my car right there and be all ticked off about it and stuff, but I'm really trying to have that default of just being, you know. So to answer your question, I'm not super serious in my life about things because I can't take myself too seriously because I know what a goofball I am, but I can try to be good to those around me, make it better, which makes it better for me. Forgive those who've messed me up because it's better for me, like that guy and like your story. I think under those circumstances and just keeping it light and keeping a sense of humor and doing jokes and having friends that understand you and won't let you get away with not being cool, you know? If you have that, I mean, what more do you need?
Half full, not half empty, right?
Not half empty.
There you go.
A little bit more full.
Yeah, man. Ideally. Absolutely. I'm going to say goodbye, but listen, man, thank you again. I really appreciate it. I hope we get to connect when you're down here and we'll stay in touch.
Well, God bless you and God bless America and all you people out there listening. Thanks for listening to my blabbering for however long this has been.
It's been great. Hang on. Let me wrap up. Everybody, and thank you. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks to Matt Bissonnette very much. There he goes. The ubiquitous toenails are always there. Support, you know, Matt, whatever Matt's doing, come check him out on Elton's gigs. And hopefully he's got something going on with his brother, Greg, and Andy Timmons, who was on this show a long time ago, called The Redcoats. So stay tuned for that. And when The Redcoats drop something, hopefully they'll come back on here and we'll be able to talk about it and turn everybody on to it. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. There you go, brother. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music. Thank you.